dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We have the pleasure right now of talking with Jim Mitchell, who was one of the key architects of the CIA's Enhanced Interrogation Program, and for the United States military was involved with the Survival, Escape, Resistance, and Evasion programs. And Jim, I just wanted to welcome you to the show, and I think be thankful that in my previous incarnations, I was on the receiving end of some of that quality training, and I would like to thank you for it and be thankful that we're not participating in that right now, because it works. That's one thing I think people like to say a lot of things about enhanced interrogation and call it names and other things like that. But the bottom line is, if you have, or if someone has knowledge that you want from them, you can make them give it to you by making their world very uncomfortable, and through some of the techniques, by letting their animal brain convince them that bad things are happening. Waterboarding, for instance, being one of them. You know, it's been maligned unfairly, and I'd like to thank you for the work you did with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others to help us gain an insight into the terrorist mind.
Yeah, one of the things that I think when they looked at this in the 50s became pretty clear was that you may not be able to get this particular piece of information that you're looking for, but you will certainly get more than you would from a voluntary questioning, especially if you're careful not to ask leading questions and not, you know, do something to implant false memories or somehow mess up the validity of what you're asking them for. So it is possible, I think, to use some pressure to get people to respond in a way that provides more information than they would have otherwise. As long as we're on that topic, and the topic of survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, one of the things that your listeners may not be aware of is that Al-Qaeda actually had a resistance to interrogation manual called the Manchester Manual that was based on U.S. Army Special Forces resistance to interrogation training. So one of the reasons that the agency and some of the other people involved thought it was important to get someone who was familiar with the way we train our own soldiers and warfighters to resist is because they were using that as a basis, some of them were, to resist our interrogation.
Well, and that's the reason for the schools, is you can learn some things. But in the end, the bottom line is, basically, everybody breaks. You know, it was amazing to me in some of the times I was able to observe some of that training. Guys who went in thinking they were the biggest, baddest, toughest guy in the world and they weren't going to tell anything were quivering masses of jelly after not too much of it, because in the end, it's not how tough you think you are. Your animal brain, you know, the bottom of your brainstem runs things. And if you can convince that you're in trouble, it will override your tough guy attitude. And that in the end was part of why you were successful.
Yeah, I think all of us make decisions about what we are trying to do based on our intentions in the moment. Well, we go into the moment with certain intentions, but events that happen in the moment can help us shift our priorities. And sometimes, rather than delaying and protecting the information, your priority shifts to providing just enough information to get this person to give you some, you know, some a chance to recuperate or some relief or a way to avoid something that you fear might happen that isn't going to happen. And when their intentions shift, when their priorities shift, is when you can start switching to social influence.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that came out in your conversations with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, specifically about how they believed that it was not going to be the violent struggle that would lead them to success against the West, that they thought our soft underbelly, kind of the overly civilized version, the politically correct influences in our society would lead us to more or less defeat ourselves. Do you think that's still applicable?
Well, I think there are probably still people at the tip of the spear for them that believe that sort of stuff, particularly on the basis of some of the reactions that you've seen to some of President Trump's policies, the pushback against those policies. Remember, these people who are fighting us are Islamists who believe that their God has given them dominion over the earth and a holy mandate to wage a continuous war until they've subjugated, converted, or slaughtered all of us, right? And so these folks who believe they're participating in a history-shaking restoration of Islamic power see America as one of their major threats to survival of that brand and the chief obstacle. And they used to believe that if they could just strike a terrible blow against Americans, that we would retreat into isolationism and they'd have an opportunity to, you know, just carry out the conquest. But they were convinced, at least Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was convinced, that even if they couldn't strike a decisive blow, we would eventually run from the fight because while we're militarily strong, we're weak in resolve and spirit. And we have short attention spans, no appetite for conflict while they love death more than life. We're weakened by our desire to have the world like us. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told me that he thought the press and the American public would turn against the war on terror and that the free media, our mainstream media, would frame their cause, promote it by framing it as impossible to win and fraught with unacceptable losses. And that in doing that, it was going to strengthen the hearts of the Muslims who were sitting on the fence around the world, and they would rise up and join that conflict.
Well, some of that seems to have come true, but they still seem to be doing a fair job of having that agenda accepted. I mean, obviously, they had the caliphate for a number of years now in Iraq and Syria, which seems to be stressed and potentially going away. But let's talk for a moment about Turkey. Erdogan is an Islamist of the first order and seems to think he might be a worthy successor for his caliph or sultan or some major role. Do you think that he might be able to, you know, from inside an Islamic state like Turkey, push that type of agenda?
It's going to be hard with the Islamists, the ones who want to go back to a closer view. See, they're Salafists, and Salaf in Arabic means pious ancestors. And so they want to wage this Quranic war of conquest, right, by following as closely as they can to the concept of wars that's laid out in the Quran and the Hadiths and in the, you know, words and deeds of the Prophet. And so when you look at things like ISIS is doing, what you see is that they're not inventing something new. They're reviving these dormant things that have been essentially discarded by history. And the problem that the leader of Turkey has is that they don't view him as a rightful caliphate. So he's going to have a lot of trouble doing. The other thing, my impression from having, and I'm not an expert on this guy at all that you're talking about, but my take on it is that he is a Salafist, but he believes that you do it through the expansion of government and you know, basically through other than violent means in the sense that that KSM and ISIS would use. So he's got a bit of a problem with them. I don't think that they will go quietly into this.
So that was part of the problem Al-Qaeda and the rest had with the Saudis, et cetera, was they had strayed from that pure path. They were no longer, you know, worthy guardians of Mecca, of the Holy Land, or any of the rest of it. And so they had to be removed by violent means. Do you think there is still enough of that mentality with ISIS and the other violent groups to maintain any momentum? Or are they, in under enough pressure from the military strife that's a problem for them?
You know, in the old days, we used to have Coke machines. And when you put your 50 cents in and the soda didn't come out, you got so used to getting a soda that you didn't just walk away. You beat the machine for a little while, you shook it, you rocked it, you reached up inside of it and tried to grab a can. Well, that's the same thing that's going to happen with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. You know, they're not going to say, oh, well, you know, we've had this, they've got this, you know, incredible weapon and they've got these military powers and people seem to be massing against us. Oh, no. Here's what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed thinks. I can tell you that what he thinks is that's God testing you. You know, if you think that when you encounter obstacles, it's God, it's Allah, testing to see if you have the spiritual resolve to be worthy, then you approach that differently than you do if you think, oh, my goodness, how are we going to make this happen now that all these people are starting to align against us? Because in his mind, the victory would be that much more sweet. And Allah's power would be that much more evident. If we can defeat all of the forces aligned against us, then what an incredible way for Allah to show his power. And what an amazing thing for me to be a participant in. Surely I'll get into paradise. Not the way that we think in the U.S.
We'll be back after the break with more discussion with Dr. James Mitchell.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Dr. James Mitchell has been telling us a little bit about insights into the mind of our enemy that he gained in specifically talking with one of the key leaders, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Now, we were discussing right before the break how the true believers, the Al-Qaeda wing, the ISIS wing, the Boko Haram wing, believe that only the most stringent and pure Quranic view of Islam and the most even extreme view, even based on the Quran, of what Islam should be, is acceptable to them. And that, like you said previously, they weren't going to stop kicking the Coke machine just because they didn't get a can every time they put their money in. Are they capable of rousing continued support? I mean, is there that level of... I mean, obviously, ISIS was able to recruit large numbers of folks to come to Iraq and Syria to fight with them. You know, they've now moved to Libya. They're in Afghanistan. Are they going to continue to be that magnet, and the folks who believe in that will continue to flock to that banner?
Well, here's part of the problem that we don't seem to acknowledge. In the most fundamental versions of Islam, regardless of what it is, people at some point in their life have to participate in the jihad. And as you know from your past experience in the military in Afghanistan and in other places like that, there's a fighting season where young men converge on whoever the enemy of the moment happens to be and fight that person because some of them, just for cultural reasons and religious reasons, need to check the box. And then from them, the true ideologues and the people who go on to be the senior leadership or the suicide bombers or whatever get sort of moved out of that. The other piece of that thing is that if you can't actively participate in the jihad, you need to support it. Now, here's what I mean. In order to wage a war of ideas, that you first have to produce a fertile ground so that the ideologies that promote a global jihad can take place. That means they have to build and sustain funding sources. And one of the things that is part of their normal tithing is that some portion of it, if you're following the most fundamental views of Islam, gets bled off into the thing. You have to develop some kind of a recruiting effort. You got to, you know, solidify public acceptance of their activities. And you got to find and acquire materials, and you got to develop power bases and local political power and safe havens. And all of that calls for things other than fighting that allows true believers to participate in the jihad so that they can, you know, fulfill what they need to fulfill to get into paradise. And so we're not up against just a few people who are trying to, attack a Humvee in Afghanistan. We're up against this megalithic. We're seeing the tip of the iceberg, but underneath there's this enormous support process that's taken place. And the bad part about this is that the political correctness that's been emerging lately has us not wanting to attack that underground support base because it seems more removed from the actual jihadist activities themselves. But without that, without funding, without local support, without safe havens, they wouldn't be able to do it.
Now, I think you've hit on one of the key problems we've had in our counterterrorism mentality overall, is it's very easy to understand how bad the violent jihadists are. Al-Qaeda knocked down the Twin Towers. You know, ISIS is burning people alive in cages. Boko Haram is kidnapping schoolgirls and selling them into sexual slavery. Those things are horrific, and people have no problem at all getting their minds around how bad that is and that those people are our enemies. The problem has come when and people like President Obama and others have tried to marginalize those folks and ignore what you just said, that absent a support mechanism, those people can't fight in a vacuum. And I think, you know, when you say it's a few extremists who hijacked a great religion, well, not necessarily, because if you poll the Muslim community, which Pew International has done, hardly a conservative organization, they found that support for suicide bombing among Muslims worldwide was as high as 28%. So those are the people who I think you're talking about there, who are paying their taxes in the mosque, who are doing the other pieces of this. And while they may not be cutting heads off, they're enabling that. And I think we have to have a mentality and a strategy that accepts and deals with that.
Yeah, I think we have to take proactive action to not sound like some sort of a talking head, but to deny, disrupt, and degrade. You know, we have to have some tactical approach to doing that. And part of it is by not allowing them to develop power bases in local mosques and religious centers. You know, one of the things Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told me, KSM, the guy behind 9/11, told me was, they don't have to defeat us. They're going to win. All they need to do is persist long enough for us to defeat ourselves by accepting their version of and acquiescing to, because that's what they really, if we simply acquiesce to what the Islamists who believe in the spread of Sharia power in the world, who actively reside in the United States now, if we just acquiesce to that, they will eventually be in charge, because they are, you know, they're having more children than we're having, they're building more mosques than we are churches, and at the same time, the military arm of radical Islam is destroying churches, crucifying, you know, Christians, and they're engaged in this sort of eradication. And ordinary Americans are breeding they're barely replacing themselves, you know. So if we do nothing at all, you know, at some point in the future, we're going to look a lot more like Indonesia in terms of the religious component of the thing. So it's a problem.
Now, you bring up Indonesia. I was in First Special Forces Group. Our area of operations was the Pacific Rim. And obviously, Indonesia being the most populous Muslim country. And I deployed there multiple times. It was a relatively unextreme, pretty mellow Islamic country. You know, they did not have, and this was in the 90s, you know, so it's been a while. But that country and Malaysia and other countries with majority Muslim populations have been leaning more toward extremist views. You know, the overall direction of Islamism seems to be dominating, as opposed to the moderate version, you know, that the folks here, CARE and other organizations that purport to represent the Muslim community, would have us believe. You know, I don't see that, and especially given, you know, the changes to Turkey, to other places where the more extreme, the more Salafist, the more Wahhabist version of Islam, and from the Iranian side, you know, the more 12th Imam Shia version, the far more radical and dangerous version seem to be ascendant. And is that something we can counter without having a much broader conversation with the Muslim people?
No, you know, I spent a fair amount of time traveling around the world, and I've worked with, beside doing interrogations with Muslims, and the vast majority of Muslims that I met are just, especially the ones who are U.S. citizens, you know, they just want to live their life and raise their kids in security, and they care as much as I do about the future of the United States. So we're talking really about the Islamists. And those Islamists who are in the United States who believe that Sharia should be in charge of the entire world, if they're willing to try that with the voting booth, and if they're willing to try that through some means other than violent means or revolution, more power to you, because that's what freedom of religion and, you know, and freedom of choice means in a democracy. It's up to us to protect our way of life. It's not up to us to expect them to protect our way of life, because they're not going to do it.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into that after the break. Folks, we're talking with Dr. James Mitchell, one of the key architects of the CIA's enhanced interrogation program and a man who had long conversations with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio. We'll be right back after the break.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Folks, it's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank, and we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. James Mitchell, author of Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. I think you made a very important point during the last segment that I want to expand on. The problem is absolutely not all Muslims. You know, there are plenty of Muslims. We've both met them. We've both worked with them, both here in the United States and overseas. I worked in, seven or eight countries with large Muslim populations, did more humanitarian work than any of the kinetic work we ever did, you know, immunizing children, building schools, digging wells. And as you said, most of those people just want to raise their families, be safe, and practice their religion in a way that doesn't mean they need to take over the world. But it would be folly for us to pretend that that is all Muslims, because it obviously is not. And again, it's easy to focus on the violent terrorists and ignore the people who support the Islamic supremacism and basically want to go ahead and do whatever is necessary, violent or otherwise, to push that agenda. Now, if we're looking in the United States, is it necessary for that message that it is not the Muslims who are just share American values and want to live with us, you know, in freedom, that are the problem? But don't we need to enlist them in helping stop the ones who don't?
Here's the problem that you're going to have, and I call it a dirty secret that nobody, and it's not really a secret, but it's one of those unspoken things. It is a sin for a Muslim to take the side of an infidel, even if the Muslim in question, who's doing whatever the action is in the wrong. So the problem that you have is, even though the more so-called moderate Muslims are not necessarily wanting to overthrow our government, even if they would like to see some aspects of Sharia in place, built into their religion are these sort of anti-sabotage ideas that prevents them from being able to openly act in our favor, if you see what I'm saying, without risking committing sins.
So now, and that obviously is the correct interpretation of, you know, the Quran, the Hadith, the Sunnah, all of the established doctrine of Islam. But the folks who would argue and say that that does not inform the lives of all Muslims, and therefore we don't have to worry about that, would say that not everybody means that, not everybody believes that. You know, there's a concept of kind of the Sunday Christian. You know, the person who goes to church once a week, or even, you know, lower on the food chain, maybe goes to church Easter and Christmas, but who says they are a religious Christian and believes they are. Is there an ability to create or believe, or does there exist a similar concept within Islam where those people can, if not ignore, at least not as reliably follow those direct requirements of the religion?
Well, you know, I'm an old white guy from Florida, right? And so for me to be even pretending to provide religious advice to Muslims would be completely rejected. But there are individual passages in the Quran and individual passages in the Hadith that would allow a person to work with infidels, particularly in situations. Well, let's imagine that you're a Islamist or Islamist-like, right? So you're more radical than moderate, but you don't really feel like you need to be fighting in the streets. Well, it is entirely possible for you to appear to cooperate with the enemy for, you know, for some period of time, if you think that not cooperating with them would set back the larger goal, right? So there's ways if you had the proper imams, but the problem is that Islam needs to be revised, right? But guys like you and me aren't going to be able to revise it. And in fact, a call from us to do that revision would be soundly rejected. It has to come from within. And, one of the things that perplexes me about our approach in the United States to this whole thing, like, for example, the cartoons or Muhammad or the Quran in the toilet here recently, which is probably going to turn out to be a hoax, or, you know, any number of these other things, is they keep talking, well, we can't let these things happen. We have to restrict our freedom of speech. We have to restrict our freedom of action. Otherwise, these moderate Muslims are going to take to the streets and there'll be riots. Well, I agree with a guy by the name of Sam Harris, who says, basically, if all of it takes to turn moderate Muslims into a lynch mob is a cartoon, then we've got a bigger problem than we're even acknowledging. I think there are pockets of this sort of Islamist perspective, particularly when we no longer require acculturation into the United States. I mean, we no longer require we put people in the basically stovepiped situations where they don't even have to bother learning English, and then the next thing you know is you have essentially a ghetto, and I mean that in the old sense of the word, not the new sense of the word. You have this area where it might as well be in Syria, or it might as well be in Afghanistan or Somalia or, some other place. And that's where this fertile ground for radicalization takes place.
Now, you mentioned when you talked about how the idea that a moderate Muslim who had no otherwise inclination to become a terrorist could somehow be radicalized simply by an offense to the religion. And again, the follow-on to that being, there should be a positive affirmation of American values if you're going to live in America. You know, I think that's a fair thing. You don't have to ascribe to all of it, but you do have to accept the fact that we are a pluralistic society. You know, we do believe that you can practice your religion, but you can't force it on other people, that you can't conduct acts like honor killings or female genital mutilation. You know, there are restrictions that you must accept and that you should be leaning that direction, as opposed to, you know, like you said, being able to be set the other direction by the slightest provocation. And I think we need to be standing up and saying that's the expectation. It's again back to the idea that the fear of offending people from political correctness stops us from making that assertion that there is something worth standing up for in American culture, leads the extreme voices in the Muslim community to go unopposed, and the rest of their community is in fear of the more extreme voices and consequently, you know, is not going to stand in opposition to them.
Yeah, I think the two most dangerous overriding ideas that we're seeing right now is political correctness and this idea that multiculturalism is somehow a more valid view, because it's really not. If your freedom of religion requires that I be subjugated by you, enslaved or slaughtered, then I just assume you didn't get an opportunity to practice your religion. I mean, just in terms of that particular piece of it. And this notion that my conversations with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed made clear to me that he views political correctness, our desire to have people like us and our desire not to receive any criticism for using our power to protect ourselves, this political correctness as a cloaking device that actually will allow them to operate in our midst without being afraid of pushback, because the pushback carries with it the stigma of Islamophobia, a term that was created by the Muslim Brotherhood to stop the pushback. So the problem that we face is we need people who are willing to put American national security ahead of political correctness and realize there are some ideas that have greater value than other ideas. Burning your wife on a funeral pyre, as they used to do in some Hindu religions, isn't something that we do, you know? And if you're a Hindu, you don't get to do that in the United States, right? And so that's there is no reason for us to commit cultural suicide in the guise of tolerance.
Folks, we're talking with Dr. James Mitchell, and in our final segment, we'll go ahead and see if we can't at least chart a few paths forward and change some of the things that have been going poorly. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. And in our final segment with Dr. James Mitchell, we're going to talk a little bit about what's been going on since President Trump was inaugurated and what he could do to kind of turn the tide on our failed policies in dealing with the Islamists, both abroad and here at home. Let's take the first thing that, President Trump did, which was attempt to enact a travel ban from particular countries with a known jihadist threat and failed states. But also in that executive order, it's often overlooked, he also called for our agencies to develop vetting procedures that allowed them to determine who might be a threat to this country other than just known terrorists, who might have belief systems that are incompatible with the Constitution, with our culture, and with our society. And I'm curious if you think there is value in both the pause in immigration from places where we can't tell the good guys from the bad guys, but then also the follow-on of attempting to determine if there are people who share beliefs. You know, like you said, you mentioned the Hindu custom of burning the widow when the husband died, which the British ruler, the British governor in India said, you go ahead and conduct your custom and throw the wife on the funeral pyre, and we'll use ours, which is shooting people who do that. So can we stand up and oppose those things here in the United States and say, if you believe that, you can't come here?
All you need to do is take a look at France and Germany and Belgium and London or England to some extent and other places like that, Sweden, where you see where they were a lot less careful about who they let in, that they now have in their midst people who are becoming radicalized in part because they came over and attempted to sort of reestablish conditions and freedom of religion to use their entire religion the way they saw it over here and that over in these other places. And so you get this sort of hotbed of people who are. Part of it comes from several dangerous ideas. You know, they believe that they've been given domain over the whole world and a holy mandate to cleanse it of all things that offend Islam or Allah. And if you don't do that, then again, you risk your soul if you're one of these true believers. And so the problem that we face is that almost everything that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said, your Western culture with its freedoms and decadent indulges cannot coexist with true Islam, with Sharia, can't coexist. We have to destroy it because it's unclean. And that's part of the problem, I think, is we just fail to recognize that.
President Trump's taking a step the right direction in saying, to start with, if you believe in violence to further the cause of your religion, you're absolutely not welcome. But also, if you believe that you can use whatever means necessary to impose your religion on others and to destroy the society that, you know, you would be joining ostensibly, then that ought to be something we consider when deciding, should we grant someone the right to come to this country? Because there is no affirmative right for anyone on the planet to come to the United States who's not already a U.S. citizen. So we grant that privilege to people. And should we be able to then say, if these are your beliefs and you are likely to push that agenda in a way that's, you know, outside of the Constitution and our laws and our culture, you're not welcome. I mean, that seems to me, like you said, the opposite of cultural suicide. That's cultural self-preservation.
Well, if we were talking about the prediction of violence as it pertained to, for example, stalking celebrities, right? The FBI has done a tremendously good job of developing protocols for predicting violence towards celebrities on the basis of how their stalkers act and some of the demographics. And the same thing is true for other kinds of violence. You know, the prediction of violence in the United States has a long history. It's used in court quite a bit. And, you know, there are several ways to do it. There are basically three ways. One way, of course, is to have some expert come in and screen the person and decide whether they're likely to be violent or not. And that actually has even for the most skilled experts, and some people have higher success rates than others, but it's still only about 1 in 3 times that they're correct on that. Then there's an actuarial way of doing it, which is basically you look at the broad statistics. You know, there have been enough people who have committed violent acts in the name of Islam that we could take their social media stuff, do something called a discriminant analysis or a factor analysis, and identify some of the features that pop up in social media that make them more at risk. And then the third way of doing that is to look at the person's own behavior. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior in similar situations. And so if I'm wanting to come into a country, let's just make one up, like Spokanistan, and at the airport, they look at my social media and I've been texting a lot and tweeting a lot and sending a lot of emails to people and visiting a lot of anti-Spokanistan websites and talking about how great it would be to kill off the infidels in Spokanistan, then Spokanistan should be cautious about letting me in.
You'd hope they would.
You know, as you said, right. So there's three ways that we could do it. The way that most people object to the most is the expert who does the screening. Actuarially, though, it's possible, in the case of mental health patients, for example, it's possible to look at the behavior of a mental health patient, their past behavior in different situations, and say, under similar situations as these, they're likely to do this. Now, it's not 100%, but it's close enough that court decisions are made on it in terms of whether they should be released or not. And in my view, if you can do that actuarially, or you can do that from looking at their own internal activity, then I think we ought to be able to do that in terms of making the decision about whether or not let some person who wants to come here, who has engulfed in their own minds these dangerous ideas, I think we ought to be able to refuse them.
Well, I think, again, it seems that people forget that you have to prove there's a reason. You know, there is no right to come here. You need to convince the United States of America that there is a reason for us to say, yes, you can come here. And if you are demonstrably, in any of the ways you just outlined, a threat to us, or at least a reasonably predictive threat, then why would we take the chance? And I think that's, you know, back to the other concept, the political correctness stops us from making that a policy.
It stops us from even looking at the data. Like I said, there has been enough people who have their presence on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and, you know, Snapchat and that sort of stuff, who have gone on to do terrorist activities, that you could pull from them a pool of people who have done those kinds of things, and then pull from them a pool of people who have similar sorts of ideology but haven't done those kinds of things. And you could, the same way you would in any other thing, do an analysis to determine what are the likely indicators. And then when you tick off those indicators, you don't let them in. But political correctness objects to that. Because for some reason, there are people in the United States who believe that our Constitution applies to everyone on the planet instead of just U.S. citizens.
And unfortunately, those people were running the country and have spread very broadly throughout government. Let us hope the new administration can get a grain of common sense involved. Dr. James Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having me on.
And please, folks, check out his book, Enhanced Interrogation: Inside the Minds of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. This is Jim Hansen. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. We will be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.